really feels like summer. It's a perfect day outside today, and we thought this would be the perfect time to have a check-in with our favorite green thumb, Gerard Lordal. He's the director of the Open Space Greening Program for Grow NYC. So glad to have you with us, Gerard.
Great to be here, Matt.
Anyone out there who has been worried about their plants in their backyards or in their windowsills or their trees surviving the summer should call us now. Gerard will take your questions, 212-433-9692, or send us a tweet. Our handle is at @middaywnyc. So, Gerard, can we just start? Can you explain what Grow NYC does, how many gardens you work with,
and
what you guys do?
Absolutely. Grow NYC is an almost 50-year-old environmental nonprofit, and we work with close to 3 million New Yorkers, and basically we provide them with services and opportunities to make New York City a healthier city to live in. Many New Yorkers and your listeners know us from our green markets. We have 51 farmers markets. We call them our green markets. The most popular is Union Square, of course, to many people, but there's Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn and 49 other markets that are not only places where you could support regional farmers who bring their produce and healthy food, seasonal food to the markets, but also now many of the green markets will allow you to bring your textiles and your food scraps and your electronic waste. Mm. So our green markets are becoming very much a hub for communities and neighborhoods. An outcrop of our green markets are our youth markets, where we hire young teenagers and we train them to actually set up farm stands that are connected to the green market farmers and their producers, and they drop off produce to the youth markets, where the kids then learn to sell produce in some of the more outreaching neighborhoods.
Some of the more underserved areas of the
exactly.
city.
Exactly. And that's our youth market program. And we also service the wholesale industry, most of our produce coming in from the regional farmers at the green market can also be used to distribute to wholesale producers, schools, hospitals, and in the future in the Bronx, we'll be opening up a wholesale distribution center up in the Bronx known as the Hub. We have an educational center, a home in Union Square at Project Farmhouse, where we educate the public about things related to healthy eating and cooking. So there's a lot going on, and Green Market, that's one of our programs. We also have Fresh Food Box, where every week people can opt in and out of purchasing maybe $25 or $30 worth of produce for $15.
Wow.
And that's very successful around the city. In my program, I run the garden program. We have built with our own funding 100 community gardens since the early 70s. Liz Christie was my predecessor, and many refer to Liz as a very well-known community garden, mother of community gardens in New York City. And I inherited Liz's work and also Kevin Shank, another predecessor of mine, who built Lots for Tots playgrounds and Plant-A-Lot gardens. And there are over 600 community gardens that are under the Parks Department.
Wow.
Yeah.
How about that?
In fact, today, Governor Cuomo was at one of the gardens in Crown Heights with the Vital Brooklyn program, where they're going to be funding rainwater collection systems in community gardens in Brooklyn.
George, let's take some callers
sure.
and see if people have any questions about keeping their plants and their gardens alive and thriving this summer.
Excellent.
Let's go to Greg in Brooklyn. Greg.
Yes. Good morning. Or the early afternoon.
Yeah. Hi.
Great program. Urban gardening, I think, is a great idea. My mom started one years ago. But my question is this. I've been trying to cultivate a grapevine, and it finally took this year. And the heat, yes, won, but I'm concerned. How do I get it through the winter? Does it need to be covered? I'll take my answer offline. Thank you so much for the program.
Thanks. Gerard, grapevines.
Yeah, grapes are a little bit high maintenance, but your grapes, the varieties that you select for New York City, should overwinter well. Check your references. There's a pretty detailed way to properly prune grapes. They're high maintenance. They need a lot of pruning. They need good sun. You have to make sure you have good air circulation so you don't get any of the foliar diseases that could attack grapes, like powdery mildew and things like that. So check your references and make sure you have it well pruned. As far as overwintering, if you have the grape in the ground, mulching can help, but generally you don't see a lot of winter damage on grapes. The biggest issue is usually pruning. So mulch it, keep it well watered in the fall, and that'll carry it through the winter pretty well, and make sure it's in a good sunny location.
Very good. Mulching and pruning. Charles in Queens, are you there? Charles.
I'm here. Thank you.
Hi there. What's your question about gardening this summer?
Yeah, I have a lawn, and I've had a problem with crabgrass in years past, and early this spring, maybe late April, early May, I put a crabgrass preventer down, and I put it all over the lawn, and it seems now in spots there's still crabgrass coming out, especially in the flower beds, and I don't know how to control it. Is there any way I can control it at this point in time in the summer?
Yeah, stepping back a little bit, you know, we're community gardeners. We have a lot of children in our gardeners, so we grow a lot of edibles. So I know this sounds a little strange talking about crabgrass in the lawn, but there is a big issue with using pesticides, and a lot of people will use pesticides to control their weeds. What we do in our community gardens and in many of the organic, you know, private gardens in the city, we try to use as much organic, non-pesticide, non-petroleum-based products as possible. We have a devastating problem with colony collapse disorder with our bees, and the scientists are connecting that with a certain group of pesticides known as neonicotinoids, and that's from an application to control grubs in a lawn. So I guess what I'm saying is manually removing crabgrass cannot always be that possible, because it takes a lot of work. But try to reduce your lawn area. Maybe think about putting in some native wildflowers in place of your high maintenance lawn. In times of drought, you're not allowed to water your lawn. Mm-hmm. There's so much money that we pour into our lawns just to prevent certain weeds. Think about maybe converting that section where you have a lot of crabgrass into a natural native flower garden or something that maybe will attract the bees, like red clover, or maybe not worry too much about the crabgrass. It's green. You could cut it as long as it looks okay. We have to protect our environment and not poison it with a lot of chemicals.
Thanks for the question and thanks for the answer. I appreciate it. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Matt Katz, and I'm talking to Gerard Lordal, the director of Grow NYC. We are taking your questions about all things summer gardening, summer planting. So give us a call, 212-433-9692. Gerard, can I ask a question that comes from my wife, actually.
Uh-huh.
She was wondering if there's a tree or a shade plant that we can put in our very small backyard patio that would look nice and maybe grow above some of the smaller shrubs.
Yeah, sure. There's lots of plant material that will survive in the shade, lots of native plants that will survive in the shade. I actually live in Brooklyn, and I have a partially shady backyard as well. And some of the flowers that do well in a shady, wet area are things like, marsh marigold would be a nice flower that would do well, or woodland phlox. Cinnamon fern would be another suggestion. I really like a lot of the ferns that do well in the shade. And I know, as far as a small shrub, there's a lot of euonymus. The Manhattan variety of euonymus grows well in my backyard. Hosta is another perennial that can do well. And as far as small trees, some of the amelanchier is a native tree that could do well in partial shade, and that doesn't grow too tall. So I would suggest any of those plants as shade tolerant, and you can check out any of the botanical garden websites, and they can give you a list as well of shade tolerant trees and shrubs.
Oh, very good. Thanks.
Yeah.
There's a question. Oh, no, we got Richard in Manhattan who has a question for you. Richard, are you there?
Hi, I am. Yes, thank you. I ordered a plant called an angel's trumpet, a tree size, angel's trumpet, blooming mm-hmm. size, from a grower in Texas. Mm-hmm. It's growing beautifully. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was an incredible water hog. Mm. And I live in Manhattan, and the tree is in Bergen County, which means I'm driving back and forth every other day now to water the thing. I have started putting a large tub under the pot and filling that with water, hoping that I can extend the my trips out in New Jersey.
Right.
So am I doing the right thing, or do
I... Well, first I want to ask, do you have those beautiful white trumpet flowers on your angel trumpet yet?
It has set blooms, unbelievable,
great.
Because I've had it for 2 months.
So a general tip for your listeners, Matt, for people who have trouble watering, a lot of times if something is in a container and they're going away on vacation, the right thing to do, or what will prevent the plant from drying out in a container, is to transfer it to a much larger container with a more substantial amount of soil around it. My experience is people who lose their plants in containers, the plant has matured to the point where it's so root bound, there's no soil and moisture in the pot. The pot isn't large enough. So make sure your pot is in proportion with the plant. The plant can be about 2.5 times the height of the pot, but make sure the pot is substantial and that you have, as your angel trumpet plant is growing, it has substantial moisture. Putting the saucer underneath is helping keep it moist because it's going to draw a lot of water, but make sure your container, your pot, is large enough and there's a substantial amount of soil around it, and you'll have better luck. It won't dry out as much. And this goes for window boxes as well. A lot of people have very shallow window boxes, and this time of year in July, plants have doubled in size. The roots are pot bound, yeah. And they're drying out, and they have to water 2 or 3 times a day. The recommendation is transfer and put them in a larger container. So
a larger
upscale.
Window.
Scale. Yeah.
It.
Scale up on the size of your containers as the plants grow and bring in more soil.
On the window boxes, are there particular kinds of plants or flowers that are like best suited for window boxes?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, there are Botanic Garden informations, but lists of plants that the Botanic Gardens give for best suited plants. But you want low maintenance plants. Many times in a window box, you want something trailing over the front. You want something in the middle of the window box and then something tall in the background. And that gives you the best look in a window box. Mm. They shouldn't be shallow. It shouldn't be metal, the container, because that heats up a lot more. So go with something at least like 12 inches deep if possible. Make sure that you're following the fire and building codes. You cannot have window boxes on a windowsill that block the egress in case of a fire in your buildings. And many apartment buildings will not allow unsecured window boxes. They could fall on people.
Right.
So be very careful, and you should secure your window box as if you're securing, just like you secure your air conditioners.
Oh, okay. With anchors and making sure it's
sure,
as stable
and if you're
as possible.
In a building that you don't own, then you want to make sure the super permits it and you don't want to block fire escapes and things like that. But marigolds and petunias and vinca and sweet potato vine and Dracaena as a spike in the center. These are all plants that are used in window boxes and look really great.
Great. Let's go back to the phone. Diane in Park Slope. Hi, Diane.
Yes. Hi.
What's your question for Gerard?
Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely.
I'm still hearing you. Okay. I'm just. I had a question about hydrangeas in a backyard that I recently gained access to this backyard. It's actually my daughter's house in Park Slope, and the hydrangeas look very robust, but we cut them back quite a bit, and they haven't bloomed, and I don't know where to kind of go from here.
When did you cut them back?
What suggestions do you have?
When did you cut them back?
Maybe a month ago or so.
Okay, so you probably cut off the flower buds. So
yeah.
The issue is you don't, on spring flowering plants like hydrangea, you don't want to cut you don't want to do pruning in the spring because you're removing the flowers. You want to prune them after they flower. Unfortunately, you won't get flowers this year. You might get a second growth, but I would just maintain the plant. You did cut them back. Hydrangeas, as a nice segue from our last caller, they are water hogs. They really like a lot of water. They will flag very easily. They will wilt. And they're an indicator of a dry soil. Your first plants to dry out are the hydrangeas. So try to keep them in a partial shade location. Keep them well watered. You could fertilize them, and their colors will change depending on the soil pH. You have pink and blue and lavender hydrangeas. So if you give them an acid-toned food, they'll usually turn blue. And if you give them a more basic type lime soil, they'll turn pink. But keep them moist and mulch them. That will keep the moisture in, and you should do better. But remember not to prune them in the spring. Prune them after they flower next year.
I'm Matt Katz, and I'm speaking with Gerard Lordal, director of Grow NYC, who's taking your calls on all things summer gardening. Listening to Midday on WNYC, I'm Matt Katz talking to Gerard Lordal, director of Grow NYC, about all things summer gardening. So, Gerard, we were talking about cutting back on certain kinds of plants. What does it mean if the ends of your plants or the ends of the leaves are turning brown? Could that mean different things depending on the time of year and where it is and what kind of species
it can,
it is?
Yeah. Our general experience is when the tips of the leaves are brown, it's water shortage. And what happens is the cells on the outer part of the leaf will be deficient in water and they will die off. And then when you water it, the remaining leaves will survive.
So you water. Don't cut them. Don't pull them off. You water first to see if that revives.
Yeah, watering can be an issue, and the brown leaves on the edges can be symptomatic of that. I want to invite your listeners to come out to the Governor's Island Urban Farm, and they could learn a lot about taking care of plants out there. So just so everyone knows, Governor's Island is the newest destination for a lot of New Yorkers and people in the region, and we have a half-acre urban farm out there, and we teach people how to take care of plants. We have all sorts of edibles out there. We have an aquaponic system where we're raising tilapia. Our neighbors are Earth Matter, and they have chickens and goats and a compost learning center, and the goats and the chickens contribute to the compost there. Our green markets accept food scraps, and many of our food scraps go to one of nine locations, one of them being Governor's Island, where those food scraps are then turned into compost, municipal compost that could be used. So you learn a lot. We have 5,000 school children coming out there from public and charter schools. We have people volunteering on the weekends. So from 12 to 4 on Saturdays and Sundays, the public can come out to the Governor's Island Urban Farm and learn about taking care of your plants to prevent those leaf edges from turning brown.
And there's also this tilapia farm there.
Yeah, we have an aquaponic system that we have about 50 tilapia that the students from the Harbor School on Governor's Island have raised. They learn how to raise fish, and then we take care of them during the summer when the school is closed. And actually, one of our students, we hired this summer, one of the students from the Harbor School to manage the tilapia, and she's taking care of 50 tilapia. And then the aquaponic system has a rooftop garden that the nutrients from the plants circulate down to the aquaponics in the tank of the fish, and then the poop from the fish actually helps to fertilize the plants on the roof. So it's a whole closed system.
And then what happens with the tilapia? Are they...
We have a slaughter at the end of the year. We usually make fish tacos, unfortunately, for the tilapia. But that's the life of a tilapia.
I guess so. Yes. I guess so. How about that? What about indoor plants? A lot of folks, obviously, in the city do not have outdoor space. They can't do window boxes. Can your apartment get too hot for plants? Is it possible that you just can't have a plant inside? Or wherever you are,
It depends on your situation. The biggest problem are air conditioned drafts. You don't want to put plants in front of big drafts, like from an air conditioner, or in the wintertime, you don't want to have them near radiators that are giving off lots of dry heat. So pick a room where you get some sunlight. Make sure there's no drafts coming from radiators or air conditioners air conditioners. And there are some really nice plants that are easy to grow. People are surprised to hear that some orchids, moth orchids or Phalaenopsis orchids that you see in many of the box stores are easy to take care of indoors and will bloom and give you good, you know, nice flowers for quite a long time. Herbs can be grown on a kitchen windowsill if there's at least 4 hours of sunlight. Things like basil, maybe some parsley, some of the annual herbs. You could even bring in some rosemary from out in the garden and then bring it out in the back in the ground at, you know, for the overwintering process. One thing I want to just mention to people, when September comes, that's often the time when any of your houseplants that you bring outside should come back in. You want the temperature to be the same indoors as out. People make this mistake of leaving their houseplants outside for the summer, and then they bring it in closer to Halloween, and that shocks the plant, and they don't do well. If you bring in your houseplants more around September, late September, when the temperature is 70 degrees in and out, then your plants will transition better.
And how often do you change the soil on those indoor plants? Or how do you even know when to change the soil?
If your plants are root bound, the soil will break away from the side of the pot often when they're very dry. It will be so root bound that there's a little space between the soil and the actual pot. That's a good indication that your plant is root bound and needs to be put in a larger pot. Also, if your plant is more than 2.5 times the height of the pot, that's usually time to change it as well and step up to a bigger pot. And if you find you're watering it, you're needing to water it so much, so frequently, that could be another indication that you need to step up and get a larger pot and add more soil for moisture retention.
There's been an effort in recent years to plant trees on New York City streets, and we're seeing more trees than we maybe used to. But there's also an issue, I'm told, with watering them regularly. Is that a problem that you've noticed, and is there a way to combat that?
Yeah, I've been gardening in New York City for like 32 years. And in the beginning, we were losing 16,000 street trees a year. Now that's gotten much better because the Parks Department is able to care for a lot of the trees. A million trees planted by New York Restoration Project and the Parks Department have added. And people know that mulch is important. They know that trees need to be watered. A lot of community groups are taking on the challenge of watering the new trees. So when the Parks Department puts in a tree, they'll often leave a tag, take care of the tree, water me regularly. This is the name of the tree. Mm-hmm. There are these plastic bags that are put around newly planted trees. They're called gaiters. And you actually pour gallons of water in those gaiters that are put around the trunk of the tree, and the water slowly seeps into the soil of a newly planted young street tree. Those are the most vulnerable. The 40-year-old London Plains and Queens and the Bronx can survive. They found water under the street. But it's the young trees, the newly planted trees that your listeners can, in New York City and the five boroughs, try to take care of the newly planted trees that the Parks Department has put in front of your house.
By taking care of, do you also mean pruning? Should people be pruning these trees?
No, you have to go through a training program to prune. What the Parks Department asks citizen pruners to do is to take the course. You could call Trees New York and sign up for the certified course to take care of street trees. But basically, you want to put water, not hot water, no detergent. Don't throw out your restaurant floor water into your tree pit. This is all damaging to trees.
Yeah.
You want cool, fresh water, and you could use those gaiters for the new trees. And very important, keep dogs out of the tree pits. Dog urine is not good for trees. It burns the roots. There is ammonia. Mm. There's bacterial issues. And mulch your tree pits. Get some mulch, wood clippings, newspaper clippings, any kind of bark chip mulch, and that helps keep the moisture in the tree pit.
Very good. On Twitter, Debbie asks, could you tell me how to make my rose bushes more continuously productive? Are there different types of bushes, some which are not as productive as others?
Okay, yeah, this is another question similar to the grape question.
Yeah.
Roses require pruning, and if you don't prune your rose, they're not going to do as well as you would like them to. There are climbing roses that you prune differently from shrub roses, but in general, you want good sunlight for roses, at least 8 hours of direct sunlight. They like full sun. As far as pruning in the winter, it's good to mostly prune back your rose because you'll get winter damage. You'll notice the rose canes will turn brown and they will die from exposure to the winter. So often the roses will be pruned down to the size of your finger, let's say, to overwinter, the shrub roses. Climbing roses, you could leave the long climbing branches. Some people will lay them down on the ground if possible and mulch them so they don't get windburn and die in the winter. But basically, you want to prune your rose in the late winter, early spring, and remove anything that's dead and allow it to generate new growth every year. And then a good rule of thumb is you don't want to fertilize your roses beyond like the end of August, because that will hold them susceptible to new young growth that could get winter kill. And fertilize, any kind of fish emulsion or organic fertilizer, compost is always helpful around your roses. And after the roses bloom, prune off the rose hips that form, that seed pod after the flower rose forms.
After the flower.
Yes, you'll get a rose hip.
Got it.
That's the seed of the rose, okay. Right? That takes a lot of energy from the flower, the bush itself. So the rule of thumb is to count down 5 leaflets and prune. And that will give you another flush of flowers.
Wow, that's a good tip. Also on Twitter, Dan asks about global warming. He said, since global warming is a reality now, as we know, will the hardiness zones be adjusted for plants? Can you explain what the hardiness zones are?
Yeah, sure. So the United States is divided into hardiness zones, and it has been changing over the years. When I started school in 1980, we were in a hardiness zone that is actually now warmer than it was 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So the hardiness zone relates to those plants that can survive in that average winter temperature. So in other words, we cannot grow oranges in zone 6-7 here in New York because they'll get frostbite. And conversely, in Florida, apple trees don't do well because they need to go through a cold period. So in places like Florida, where the temperature is on an average much higher, certain plants will grow. Mm. As climate change has been affecting us and the heat island effects and all of that, we have noticed that our hardiness zones are changing and they're all getting warmer. So we're stepping up.
And that's changing the kinds of plants that are amenable to be planted here.
Yeah.
So,
for instance, we grow pawpaw up here. We grow figs. These are Mediterranean plants that generally like it really warm. But they tend to do a little better because things are getting a little warmer. And we notice these changes. So this is what the scientists, I understand, are telling us, that the hardiness zones are slowly getting warmer. And we see that.
Well, we're facing global warming, but we get to grow figs. So that's, I guess, a silver lining. Connie in New Jersey on Twitter asks, when is the best time of year for replanting a myrtle bush? Might you know the answer to that question? A myrtle bush.
Okay. So generally, for all your listeners, transplanting is best done when the plants are dormant, whether it's a myrtle or whether it's a tree or hosta. So you don't want to shock the plant. Mm-hmm. So early spring is often the best time to transplant, or late fall when leaves have dropped. The only exception would be evergreens. Those plants that hold their needles, they like to, they go dormant in the summer. So evergreens are approaching their dormant stage now, and that's the best time to move or to prune evergreens like myrtle.
Very good. We have a caller, Billy in Bayside. What's your question, Billy?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I have hostas in my garden, and I notice every year during the hot summer months, the tips look burnt, they're brown, and they have little holes in it. And I'm not sure if it's a worm or if it's a beetle. I'm not sure.
I'm sure many of the listeners are saying, I know the answer to that, and it's slugs and snails.
Oh. I figured that.
So they love hosta, and they generally will come out at night so you don't see them. They'll leave a slime trail. You'll see a shiny trail as they move.
That's what I have, yes.
So what you could do is put sand around, a coarse sand around your hosta. The slugs and the snails cannot travel on sand because their body will get lacerated from the sharp sand particles. So some people find success with that. Or you could sink a aluminum pie plant pan of stale beer in the ground. And some people find that the fermenting beer attracts the slugs, and they fall in the beer, the pie pan that's recessed in the ground, and they actually drown. And that's another way to control your slugs. There are products on the market that contain formaldehyde that I don't often recommend, but that's another slug bait and snail bait that you could put down. But those are organic and not so organic options for you.
Yeah, we're actually getting several calls from people who want to garden organically, but they have problems with invasive weeds or bugs eating their plants. Are there general rules of thumb?
Yeah, so general rules of thumb, people, it's surprising how effective cleanup can be. People tend not to clean up under their fruit trees and removing those old fruits from the years before that have insects and diseases in them. By cleaning up under your peach tree, your fruit trees, by picking up old leaves, those leaves harbor insects and pests, and that could be a problem. Gardening organically, that's all we do. We use compost, we mulch a lot, we use fish emulsion, we use liquid calcium to prevent blossom end rot on your tomatoes. So Rodale is a great source of information, Rodale Press. They have a website. They've been around for decades now, giving out information on organic gardening. So we only, in the community gardens around the city, because so many community gardens have children in them, they have edible food products. We don't use any pesticides. We're composting. We're releasing ladybugs to kill other insects. Any of the beneficial insects like nematodes, praying mantis, ladybugs, these are all great things to use in your garden as a biological control. Don't leave any standing water, buckets of water, because they will attract insects that could then cause diseases. Air circulation is very important too. If you have large shade trees over your garden, that's going to prevent your plants from having good air circulation. Roses will get powdery mildew if you don't have good air circulation. So pruning excessive leaves off of those bushes to allow air circulation will help. Removing weeds is another cultural control that is organic. If you pull the weeds out before they go to seed, that's a lot better than putting down some toxic pesticide in your garden as a weed killer. Using weed barriers, landscape fabric, these are all things that you could smother weeds. You could pull them out manually, make sure you get the roots, remove the weeds before they go to seed. These are all practical rules that organic gardeners use to keep their garden pesticide free.
I'm always trying to get my three-year-old to help me weed, and he loves it, but he does not get it to the root. But I want to encourage him, so I let it go.
It's a start.
Yeah, exactly.
Pulling the
right
top off is a start. Then daddy can pull the roots the rest of the way.
Exactly
right.
Thank you so much for joining me, Gerard.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
I'm Matt Katz, and I've been speaking with Gerard Lordell, director of Grow NYC, about summer gardening.